He's about 455 yards away. He's going to hit about a 2-iron, I think.
This is the School of Motion podcast. Come for the MoGraph, stay for the puns.
The situation we're seeing with producers in our industry today is that we're missing that education that used to happen when you had 100 people in a room and there were PAs and then there were coordinators and there were producers and you had the ability to make your own. Now we're very segmented. We're missing some of those positions that people could learn, the apprenticeship positions, people could learn hands-on. We are just infusing people at gigantic problems, hoping they get it right and hoping that Slack and Harvest, you know, do their job. It doesn't all kind of click.
We know there's a talent crunch. We know there's a rush to get artists of every shape and kind out there in the industry. But you know where the real problem actually lies in motion design? It's with producers. That's right. We're going to talk about the producer problem today with two of the best people I could think of. But before we dive into that, let's just hear a little bit from one of our School of Motion alumni.
Hi, my name is Joey Judkins, and I'm a 2D and 3D freelance animator and director. My love for drawing and illustrating was actually really limited by my knowledge of software. So I was very comfortable just drawing in a sketchbook, drawing on, even on Procreate, but that's kind of where it stopped. And so when I got to the point where I thought, I really feel like I would like to learn more about Photoshop and Illustrator, and I'd like to be able to make some of my own illustrated boards someday. So this is where School of Motion came in. I took Jake Bartlett's Photoshop and Illustrator Unleashed course in 2018, and then I followed that up with Sarah Beth Morgan's Illustration for Motion course in 2019. And I finally learned the techniques that I needed, combined with some software tips and tricks to be able to turn those sketches into final finished illustrations. So thanks, School of Motion. My name is Joey Judkins, and I'm a School of Motion alumni.
Motioneers, normally we talk art, we talk artists, we talk tools, we talk a little bit about the industry, everything you can think of, but there's a whole other role out there that you interact with every day, and you may not really think about who that person is, where they come from, how they got there, and if you fit into that role as well. But today, I really wanted to bring two of the best deep thinkers, the rev thinkers, if you will, about the motion design industry. I have Tim Thompson, chief revolution thinker, and Joel Pilger, managing partner, to talk about what I like to call the producing problem that we have in motion design. Tim and Joel, thank you so much for coming on. I have a million questions, but I just want to say thanks. I know you guys are super busy, especially in 2021.
It's good to be with you, Ryan. We love you and appreciate you being in our community. And Tim, I know you you also have mad respect for Mr. Ryan here.
Almost too much respect, Ryan. Who you are in our industry, I find that your insights and thoughtfulness everywhere I see you and get interact with you is great. So happy to be part of this podcast, and we truly are fans of it.
Well, thank you so much. Before we dive too deep, can you just give someone, you two are both so good at telling other people how to sum up what they do in one sentence, in a short amount of time, in a bullet point list, in like the briefest amount of time. But I want to throw the challenge back at you. For someone who has not heard of RevThink, what is the shortest, most concise, most exciting way to tell people what RevThink actually is?
Oh, I love it. Putting me on the spot here. Tim's pointing at me like, Joel, this is yours. This is yours. So we exist to help creative entrepreneurs thrive in business and in life and in career. So what that looks like is We're a consultancy, but really what we're doing is fostering a community of business owners that span animation, motion design, production, sound, music, and so on. And really bringing them together and giving them the tools, the support, the resources they need to thrive.
So what I love, Tim, how did he do?
He did pretty good, actually. I was taking notes for next time.
what I honed in on that, though, what I love about it is that, you know, we've tried to expand the discussion at School Motion to talk about those things, but the fact that you call those three things very separate things, right? Like, you can say career, and that means a lot of different things to people, but you call that career, business, and life as three distinct, unique challenges to be thinking about. Can you talk just a little bit more about how you approach those three different things with your clients, with the people who are stewards of the industry?
Yeah, it's you know, those three separate things are actually different revelations we've had mm-hmm. over the time of the work that we're doing. I personally have a career in this industry. I was once a producer. I did head of operations at Imaginary Forces. I've written software and operations software and Trailer Park and other large production studios. And then I got into consultancy to help really like problem solve. Mm-hmm. So when I first got into that, I was clearly helping people with their business and solving business issues. But the individuals that came to me had issues greater than I could take an, you know, solve on a P&L sheet of a, mm-hmm. for someone's business or a production pipeline. They were asking greater questions. And I started realizing success in business is the beginning of the things you need to do in life. And you're really, the reason you might have started a business is for a, maybe a life goal or some other greater purpose of influence. So those two, life and business, definitely kind of play themselves out. But I think the one thing that we forget to navigate is our entire career. So when I explain to you what I've done over my career is I've gone from one place to the next, to the next. Each one I was leveraging up, making myself different and making myself more valuable. And that navigating in your career is often something people don't think about. They don't think about how I'm going to go from point A to Z step by step along the way. And there is a possibility of strategy and politics and opportunity and luck that play into it. But you have to navigate all three of those separately in different circles. And then, of course, if you Venn diagram that, you would find like who you are in the center.
I love that because I feel like you said A to Z. I think a lot of motion designers or people who have transitioned to creative directing or maybe even running their own shop, they can't see to C, right? They might have been an A and they got to B. C was very murky. They stepped into a world full of fog that they didn't understand. And you don't even know that there's a D, E, F, let alone potentially a Z. Like I like to say it all the time, and maybe it's a little bit of a hyperbole, but we're still in like the Mark One of motion design, or the first generation, right? There's not many of us who have actually retired and said, you know, waved goodbye to the industry, you know, in a full way. And especially now
from the digital platforms, right?
Yes.
Because there were definitely a generation before me that were doing it hand. They were hand building Steve Frankfurt-esque generation that was building this stuff. Yeah.
And I couch that. I've had this recent revelation that I woke up in the morning after driving back from LA for a week. I woke up straight up in my bed and said to myself, like, oh my God, for as many times as I like to call myself a creative director or a motion designer or an animator, really, I work in advertising. And I think that's starting to change. The possibilities are starting to change. But the people you are talking about, they very firmly were doing animation or motion design or title design, but they were working in advertising. And then maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later when we get to like predictions, but motion design potentially is starting to expand beyond the possibility of just that with NFTs and all the other things that are out there.
Yeah, I do remember the days where motion design might be the first time we ever said those words separate as a discipline. Then really the art department at an advertising agency or something along those lines.
Yeah, the creative department, the art department. Yeah, exactly.
And I think, you know, what's funny is so it, that whole generational thing that you point out there for a second was, I first started when I produced the 7 title sequence, we did that manually. Like we had physical elements and we're shooting it on film. And I've sat down across many future clients, and in my introductory conversation with them, I told them I produced the title sequence, and they would say to me, oh, I recreated that in design school on a computer. Yeah. And I kept thinking like you had nothing, like the way we made it and the way you're replicating it are two different elements. So yeah.
It's like playing a video game about driving and actually driving a car.
Exactly.
They're at best tangentially related. I have to tell the audience this is a fun conversation for me because this is coming full circle, because my first seat that I took at Imaginary Forces was directly under pitch boards that were placed into a frame from 7. So like there's something resonating here between just your experience doing it and my experience sitting in through osmosis, absorbing all of the good stuff that came from that frame.
Did you ever see the frames of the end crawl?
Yes.
They used to have those 3 frames. So my wife actually typed that. And I remember the day that Kyle showed up with it destroyed like that. And the group we were working with, Pacific Title, were so frustrated that he ran over it with a car. He cut it with a knife. Yeah. He put bugs inside of it. He put hot sauce on it. I mean, he destroyed this piece of art, which made it really impossible to actually make the end crawl, but absolutely genius move. So that's fun to see that physically.
I think it's oh man, we're going to go down the NFT slide pretty quick, but I think there's something very interesting about the world returning back to the tactility of the, for lack of a better term, digital world, the idea of being able to combine physical and digital and have both used to their best express intents and inform each other. But that's going way off the path. I think we could go down memory lane for imaginary forces or go way into the future about NFTs. But what I really want to talk about is, you know, RevThink has had this really incredible, very singular place in the industry in terms of if you start your own company and you have a modicum of success to be able to be open for more than a year or two, there is a crossroads that you hit that you are isolated to a certain degree. You are in unknown territory because you probably were an artist who's now running a company. You're psychologically struggling with whatever that kind of minefield is. There, previously to RevThink, had really been no place to go to find common ground or to find a mentor, really, unless you were introduced to someone else. But there's been no formal way. There's no website. There was no person that you could ask, like a White Wolf Fixer from Pulp Fiction. But I feel like RevThink has grown into the place to be, the place to go. I have lots of friends who are like, what do you know about those guys? But I feel like this year, 2021 has been a decade in 1 year. A lot has happened. What has happened to RevThink and how have you position yourselves, and what have you done to help these people that, you know, the mission has changed. 2021 has changed everything. And I don't think it's temporary. I think it's forever and it's fracturing and it's ongoing. But what has 2021 been like for RevThink?
Well, there's definitely, you know, 2020 brought so much to a head in such a short amount of time. And, you know, one thing I would explain is that, you know, we help people solve problems. And last year, 2020, everyone had a problem. You know, either they had no work or too much work. They were working remotely. They were working differently. Their clients were asking had different demands of them. Their life was coming into it. So all these issues that came to a head and at the speed at which it came to a head, we obviously were reacting to that. We're putting ourselves out more publicly. We did weekly or daily video cast for a while so we can really just like make an impact on some of the issues that were coming up. But one thing we really started recognizing is the universality of the problems we're solving remained the same. Mm-hmm. We still were solving life issues, career mm-hmm. issues, and business issues. We were just dealing with them at a different pace.
Right.
And in some cases, at a greater extreme, but not a greater extreme than we were unfamiliar with, mm-hmm. with some of our clients. It's just that a higher group or a greater group of people were dealing with those issues at the same time. Mm-hmm. So that created a pivot for us. You know, I started RevThink about 12, 13 years ago. And when I started, I was like the wolf. I was really just a one-to-one problem-solving person. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I really started working with Joel, who had the vision of scale and creating masterclasses and putting groups together and building community to solve this problem, that RevThink was able to make a shift. And I think in the last year, Joel, you can kind of verify kind of this stuff that you've been rolling out, but that community solving its own problems is probably some of the greatest excitement we have. And inside Rev Community, an online platform we have, you know, the owners are talking to each other. And Ryan, you're one of the people participating, asking the questions and finding the answers.
There was a safer time, I feel like, in motion design ending a year or two ago where everything was just like, okay, Cinema 4D or After Effects or live action. We know how to book them. We know how to kind of like kind of price them. It's fairly reliable. We have the crew that we always use. We know who we outsource, just fit it into the box. And now I feel like we're returning right back to Wild West times again. Like anything can be everything. It can cost, the rates change like based on what somebody's doing, if they're on vacation or if they're doing a NFT that week. Like it's, the variability is all over the place.
Yeah, it's actually reminiscent. So I think I've been lucky enough to be around during the late 90s, early 2000s transition onto a digital platform. Because mm-hmm. I think some of the questions that we're asking, even though about a different transition and a different type of transition, to watch an optical house and a physical practical house slowly disappearing or trying to find what their footing is going to be in a mm-hmm. space that went fully digital.
Yeah.
Is what I'm seeing now is very reminiscent of that kind of move. I mean, it was right before the dot boom, you mm-hmm. know, the internet was only about websites. It wasn't about really producing much else. You know, right. We produced like the homepage for Netscape or something like that. You know, it was kind of like low end. There was no YouTube. So no greater influence impacting or pushing against our economy.
Right.
And then, you know, just overnight, a desktop computer could process at the same speed as a $100,000, $200,000 item. And the old model of if you build it, they will come, slowly disappeared. No more post house, no more video house, no more color correction place. We can just do that in our small little boutiques. And a boutique back then was like 100 people. Today, a boutique's like 5 people. And all garage. Those people have gone away.
In 5 separate garages.
Yeah. Some of the situation we're seeing with producers in our industry today is that we're missing that education that used to happen when you had 100 people in a room and there were PAs and then there were coordinators and there were producers and you had the ability to make your own.
Yeah.
Now we're very segmented. We're missing some of those positions that people could learn, the apprenticeship positions people could learn hands-on. And we are just infusing people at gigantic problems, hoping they get it right and hoping that Slack and Harvest, you know, do their job. It doesn't all kind of click.
I think I want to rewind a little bit back to what you said, because I feel like there's a certain amount of consternation, I think, amongst like creative directors and art directors that this distributed, everything remote, everyone kind of sitting in their own space, working alone is going to affect the artist pipeline eventually, right? Like right now there's a talent crunch, but the eventual, like all those people who used to be juniors that got to work with seniors that then got to be exposed to clients, but in a safe space with, you know, creative directors around them, that is going to be subverted and kind of like almost capped off, right? Like it's not the same experience, right? If you're not in the drive, in the car with the creative director and the producer, listening to them talk about how they're going to approach the pitch, then you walk in the room and you see how you handle that. And then you come back and do the postmortem and you have that cumulative shared experience, that pipeline of like, I go from junior to all this, that, like that gets disrupted at some point, right? And we have no formal training or any kind of institutions that help replace that. I would argue that we've been feeling that with producers for at least the last 3, 4, 5 years, because the amount of things motion design is asked to do, no one can understand all of those, right? And there's no place where you go, okay, for the next year, I'm going to learn just how to do XR related projects. And then for the next year, I'm going to train myself as a producer to do just broadcast. And then I'm going to be this kind of like Bruce Wayne, Batman superstar 6 years into it. That does not exist. And I feel like we're already feeling the effects of that, because like you said, there is no, you were from Imaginary Forces. I was there. You'd come in as a PA. You might be able to be a coordinator. You'd sit and watch a junior producer. That junior producer gets promoted to a senior. They spend a little time and then you hop into like a one-off senior producing position, but you have somebody there to kind of like guide rail you. And then you just work your way up into head of production, managing producer, whatever those things might be. There's a natural hierarchy the same way artists have. And that has been gone for, I feel, quite a while, or it's been on its way out.
I've seen junior producer relationships in the last 10 years, but I have never, the word coordinator has rarely existed unless you're talking about a resource manager only. So a solo position of just finding booking talent. But PA, I mean, why would you need one anymore? There aren't any, there's no need to have just people sitting around waiting to help fix something with clients. Don't show up into your office anymore. There isn't tapes to run across town. So that generational thing that we skipped is really something that you can see it in truly the age of most producers, or at least successful producers. You can just see it in our age. I was a producer at 24. I haven't met a 24-year-old producer at all.
No, but I've seen a lot of 24-year-old predators. I feel like predators ate the PA job, PA title. You're expected walking in the door to be able to throw a little bit of graphics together, know how to write a good email to a client, be able to produce, sit on Final Cut or Premiere and cut something together, make a sizzle, do some social media. You know, like that is the equivalent of what a PA position used to be 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 7 years ago. Joel, how do you feel about this? Because I feel like, you know, we probably also hear from a lot of studios, you guys hear probably more than I do that, you know, I can't find the artist I need, or I want to pitch and I don't know how to do it. But I feel like it's even a bigger problem, even a step before that, is like, how do you have the talent that knows how to respond to an RFP? How do you bid out a job knowing if you can actually take it on or if you can make a profit on it? Like, are you feeling that same kind of pressure that I keep on hearing from my friends at studios and people that I know that are running small operations?
Well, I think what's really challenging about the producer role, first of all, to start with, is it's really not a defined role that you can go out there and go to school, you know, go to school of motion, learn how to be a producer, go and get your graduate degree. It's just not like the other disciplines, right? Like motion design, at least you can take courses and come out and say, I know how to do this. What's the equivalent? What's the analog for a producer? So there's a lot of confusion about what even is a producer? What does a producer do? What impact do they have? So that's part of the problem. Because when I was running my business back, you know, now till 7 years ago, but I'm thinking back 15 or 20 years ago, producers were these magical creatures that when I was first running my business, I was convinced I don't need a producer because I can do the project myself. I'm a creative, I'm organized, right? I can do this. And it wasn't until scale and also this thing I saw happening where I was trying to be the creative person and also the production person at the same time in one brain, and it was failing. And I had clients saying to me like, hey, we trusted you on this project. It turned out great, but we'll never work with you again because the process was so difficult. And this was the moment when I realized, oh, scale and speed, you have to divide these things in your brain. Let the creatives be the creatives, but let the producers get the work done and make sure that the client's happy and that we're on time, on budget, all these things. So even I had this ignorance and had to learn the hard way what the role of the producer is. And once I hired my first producer, everything changed. And I started saying, I'm going to make this investment. I'm going to find more producers because they make such a business, you know, impact on my business. But there was really no understanding other than I got lucky and hired a senior producer. So when other producers came on, she was able to coach and mentor that PA, that associate producer, that junior producer, that mid-level producer. And that created a culture and an understanding of what the production ingredient is in a business. This is one of the reasons that Tim and I have been for a couple of years been trying to figure out how do we help the industry understand the producer role, the producer method, and start meeting those needs. Because as you said, Ryan, huge demand right now. And some business owners don't even know they have that need. And trust me, they do. They do. We all know it. But the people that are running the larger shops, they know they have the need. They are just really struggling to get the talent or to make their own producers.
Right. There's so much to unpack there, Joel, because you said something that made me laugh, because I feel like it's the creative's motto, but it doubles down as the motion designer's model is, I think I could do that. Let me just do that. I don't need anybody else to do it. I'll just do it. And I think that is one of those things that it allows you to find a certain amount of success early on in your career, and it becomes your instinct, and then it becomes your crutch.
Yes.
And you carry that with you as you consider starting a studio. But I think the other thing, one thing I love to talk about at School of Motion is trying to find things that studios or companies or sister industries do that we can borrow as the individual operator or the someone running a small collective. And one thing that I think is really interesting is a lot of people listening to this probably don't think they need a producer because they think what they're selling is the final product is the work that they're sitting at the box right now making.
Right.
But what you just said really goes back to what I think is one of the hallmarks I've heard both of you say all the time at RevThink is that really what you're probably selling to your client is at least 49% how you got to that final product you've been sitting on the box doing. If not, the majority of it is actually, what was it like? Was the process smooth? Did I feel involved? Did I feel taken care of? Do I feel trustworthy? Do I feel like I was trusted? That does not come from being great at Houdini. That does not come from being a great creative director. That comes from your producer.
Thank you. And there was a moment when I had produced this amazing all CG spot. Do you remember Paint Effects in Maya? We had done this car commercial with a CG vehicle, and it was so hard to do. And we did it, we pulled it off, we hit the deadline, the spot looked fantastic. And the agency for this big car company calls me and says, dude, the spot turned out great. It looks amazing. And I'm just calling to let you know we'll never be working with you again.
Yes.
Yeah, Ryan, I had a good friend who told me, he was a producer, and he told me the reason he chose to be a producer was when the Oscars are handed out, you know, best director goes to the director, but best picture goes to the producer. And it's this idea that the whole product is wrapped in production, because there is a client deliverable that if you don't deliver, it honestly doesn't matter how gorgeous it is. And then vice versa, you can always deliver, but if it's not gorgeous, you're not going to, you know, it also won't be accepted. So there's these two parts to the equation that the client you're working with wants to know that they're covered. And like you said, originally, there are way too many business owners now that are basically inventing or making up what production and a producer would do based on what their entrepreneurial ability is when they started their creative business as a creative person, without any real experience of understanding there's a technique and a skill and a method to getting the project done, giving confidence to the project and to the client, and then also, you know, protecting and financing the creative vision. And that's what a lot of creative businesses would really benefit from, is knowing that somebody is there to making sure the vision comes true. And beyond just, you know, coordinating people showing up on time and making independent contractor agreements or whatever tasks that we give these producers' roles today.
Yeah, I find it really fascinating to talk about this, because until you've actually been through the ringer a couple times, and on both sides, as a creative director, as an artist, or somebody who's had to help produce, you realize that most creatives are either really good at being a good cop or really good at being a bad cop. Very few know when and where to be either of those. And that's what a producer has always helped me. They've always been able to say, like, A, done is always better than perfect in a company. Like, you can be perfect with your own art, but they've always been able to help me when I'm too close to the metal or too in the clouds to be able to remind me, like, look, right now we need to walk in the room and be the good cop, because there's some challenges coming along the way. Or, you know what, you go ahead and be the bad cop and explain to them why the direction needs to be this way, and I'll smooth things over. But having that partner, having that person that can see the forest for the trees, or remind you to get pulled up into the clouds when your nose is inside your motherboard, those things are the things that I always remind myself, like that partnership, that person that's helping you see everything is really, really helpful.
I'll piggyback on where you're going with what you said, Ryan, because we just finished this thing we call the Producer Masterclass. And in the masterclass, we were teaching what the producer method. The ultimate goal of the producer method is to get people to make decisions. So it's decision-making is what it's all about. And how do we get to a point we can make decisions? And it goes way beyond, like I was saying earlier, the systems of like a budget and a schedule or harvest or whatever, just the software systems and managing that and getting the data in there. Way beyond that, to that, you in those systems, you have to create visibility that then give you insight. And that insight helps you understand the decisions that need to be made. You're not making the decisions, but at least with the insights you're getting, you understand those decisions, you have some visibility to understand the impact of those decisions. And then you want to grant permission or receive permission if you're the producer in order to make those decisions on behalf of the company, the project, and the client, and the creative team. So that guiding or building up of your producer is a way greater impact on all the possibilities a project can go, the relationship you can have with a client in the long term, the direction of your business, and even the direction of your career. If you find a good partner and a producer, that producer can make really amazing things with you for your entire career. I think there is a great magic and ability in our industry when we are finding those connections and making them well.
I mean, I love what you said about that, because I really feel like that's half of the producer's, I don't know, the plight or the producer's issue is there really are those four things, right? You said the project itself, the company, the client, and the creative team. Like, you're literally juggling four of those. You're spinning all four of those plates at the same time. And it's very typically not just one set of four plates. You're looking at the past and trying to figure out what to learn from or to avoid. You've got whatever's current right now, but a producer a lot of times is also like the tip of the spear when the future jobs, the RFPs are coming in, the requests, the bids, the all of those things. Is that something you talk about in the Producer's Masterclass? Because I feel like, you know, there's a lot of like tactical things, right? There's tools. You've talked about Harvest a couple of times. There's things that you can adopt in methodology, but there's also just kind of like big picture point of view, like being able to understand. Do you talk about that in producer's masterclass. Like, how do you get your head around the full suite of things a producer is going to be asked to kind of, you know, take advantage of or take control of in a studio?
Well, I'll jump in and say the lesson I've learned about what separates the really good producers from the great ones is that great producers anticipate, right? So it's like they're managing expectations all the time with the team, especially with the clients, but they're also anticipating. And I will say the other plate that they're spinning, which is a word to me that was conspicuously absent back there, was the word cash. Like, producers are empowered. Like, great producers are empowered with not just the responsibility of getting the work done, but the authority to go and spend money, to spend the time and the resources. And so they have enormous, I mean, Tim, who has more power and control over the money that's spent inside of a creative company than the producers?
Yeah, often it's 50 to 60% of the financial decisions being made are being made by producers, not business owners, because that's where your cost rate is on projects. And in some companies, even greater, or some types of projects are even greater. You know, Joel, one of the words we use when we were teaching the idea of anticipate the future needs is we specifically use the word visualize, that a producer visualizes the desired future state, is how we said it. And I like to choose that because I think we often only allow creatives to have vision and picture things. But I know personally as a producer, and I know the really great producers I've worked with, they sit down and they're thinking of the project and they have to, in their mind, visualize that future state so that they can see the parts that need to be produced, the specific products and pieces to put this whole thing together, how we're going to get there, who's going to help create that with us, what skill level do they need? And that that vision that they have complements very much the creative vision. And I think that's why there's two parts to it. But the other word that we were very careful on was this idea that the producer also has to empathize with problems. So they have to be empathetic with what the client's actually trying to solve, the real problem the client's trying to solve, not just get our job done, and the real issues the creative's up against, so that it's not just pushing and pushing, pushing like a work boss, but actually understanding the parts and complementing financing and working through solutions.
I've always found it very interesting how in the worst of shops, there's almost a rivalry between the creative side and the production side. Like, there's sometimes it's physically, like the producers sit above or below and they're in a separate place. But a lot of times it's just strategically, it feels like they're set up against each other. Like their goals and intentions are actually like, oh, you know what? Creatives have to try to get the most beautiful, most creative, most inventive thing. And the producers have to make sure they don't bankrupt the company. But the best situations I've been in is when they're joined at the hip as like true partners, because there's something interesting when you work at a shop as a creative that gets to work with a producer, that you're not just looking at that one job. You're also looking at the jobs alongside it, the opportunities getting ready to come in, and the ones that have just finished that may be able to be exploited or leveled up for an even bigger relationship. You know, the job that just shipped is sometimes the best way to open the next stage with that client. The creative director is very rarely ever thinking about that, but they're going to get tapped on the shoulder by the producer to make it happen. Those two people should be working way more together in the big picture, in the vision kind of state of the studio as well. Have you ever really had a producer that's been able to do that? That's been able to kind of be like, oh, I understand the wide picture, but also can go very deep on one single thing at the same time? Because I've only had, in the 20 plus years I've been here, I've only had one partner in my entire career that's been that type of producer.
Well, I'll say yes. I've been fortunate to work with some producers, especially like at the senior and executive producer level, that really do have that sense of, I'm here to facilitate and bring to life this vision called, this is where this creative company is going. But I do that by interfacing with clients and solving their problems and being an advocate for my creative teams. But the motto that I would come back to, this is something that Tim, you should talk about this, because you remember there was an era in our industry when the companies, and I'm going to say like the sales and the finance, the production side was winning. And it was sort of a dark era. And the motto that I was referring to that, Tim, I heard you say many, many years ago was, no, creative must win. And it's a very simple statement that says, look, if every project, sure, is going to have like a creative lead and a producer lead, but those people are collaborators. Now, do they fight mm-hmm. and argue and battle and negotiate? Absolutely, they do. Right. But it's always in the spirit of, we're going to figure this out and creative has to win. And so I think there's ultimately a deference that the producers in a way work for the creatives, they work for mm-hmm. the owners, and they work for the clients. And this is part of the reason that great producers are massively talented, because they really have three bosses.
I do think there is a tension when one person believes they have authority over the other. So you can imagine in a bad creative producer relationship, the producer believes they have the authority to shut things down, to stop the creative direction from flowing, because they have authority over the project because of budget that's been granted to them or schedule that the clients imposed on them. But that tension can also be healthy, where there really is a limit no matter what. These aren't infinite projects with infinite client needs. There has to be some parameters, even to keep the creative team healthy, to say, hey, we can't work forever, extra hours beyond the limits what the client gave us. So it's really, when it's working well, it really defines the creative problem to solve. And that's what most of our clients are doing, is creative problem solving. And the producer is the one that gets to define those limits so that the creative is solving the right problem with the right amount of resources. That's the result you're looking for. It's matching those resources and those needs and living within those limits. So it, to be a person that has that burden, I can understand producers becoming frustrated, being pushing people, being pushed over the limits. And when the owner is a creative person, they often feel like they don't have a voice. That can be very unhealthy, but there really is a symbiotic relationship when done well. And that's what we want to teach about mastering the creative ingredient in RevThink, is understanding those limits.
You know, we've mentioned Producer Masterclass a couple of times now, and I'm really interested in finding out, like, who is it necessarily for? Because we've talked about the wide range of ways you can get into producing, the wide range of ways of actually defining what producing is. Like, who are you targeting? Because there is a dearth, like we said. School of Motion does not have a producing class. There's no place you can go. You can't go to LinkedIn Learning or Skillshare and get a really solid course or instruction about how to become a producer or how to be a better producer. So what is it all about? Who's it for? And when is it going to be available again?
Well, you just gave me a great, great idea. I should call LinkedIn Learning and see if they'll take our producer masterclass and put it on it. That'd be really great. You know, it's funny. You asked the question earlier of like how RevThink has pivoted in the last 12 months. And this is one of those areas where our primary focus has been on the business owner, the creative business owner, and helping that person navigate what it means to run a creative business, as well as be a creative director or salesperson or producer, whatever that primary role might be. This is one of the first times we actually reached into the company and said, hey, we will train your producers for you. And then signed up people who want to be producers, regardless of their ownership criteria. And we did that because we recognize our clients needed somebody to build up their production team or future production team, give them some skills that might have been missing, or at least some insights that might be missing in the job that they're doing. But also hope that we had something available for a greater market. If someone was interested in production, or had the need to grow their business and realized they were missing that production ingredient, we would have a resource available to them. So future goal is really to make this available and make it available often. When Joel, in the last few years, has really worked hard to develop, as I said earlier, our community, and in that, our learning platforms. And so as we evolve this program, we're going to do it again in early 2022, probably with another 15, 20 producers like we did last time, we will then be able to capture this and even put it in video and let people take it passively. It's probably not the greatest thing to do just solo, because mm-hmm. there's some interaction that I think is vital to some of the learning of some of the skills, but it's definitely something that we think we can do at scale in the future.
it was fun when we ran this first class that maybe a third of the people participating were owners. So we were targeting producers, but also in a way owners, because there are still a lot of owners asking, okay, what exactly is a producer and how does the role work? And then they're also asking, if I can't find one, how do I make one? And that, of course, I think is a skill that every producer should master at some point, is if I'm going to make a producer. But to Tim's point about the group and the live dynamic, we love the fact that when you have 15 owners and producers in a masterclass setting and it's live, the questions, the discussion is incredible. When you think of, like, there's some real rock star producers from all over the world that are at the senior or executive or head of production level. And then you have a junior producer or someone who's not even yet a producer, but wants to become one. And the sharing and the interaction, I mean, even just picking up the bedside manner and some of the ways that they talk and the way they think, there's a lot of really cool nuance that comes across in that experience.
Yeah, what I love about what you're saying is it sounds like the Producer Masterclass, there's a place for anyone who's interested in producing. Like you said, an owner who wants to get a better sense of how to craft one out of thin air, the producers who want to get better, who may have been isolated or may have had a limited amount of mentorship to learn the tips, the tricks, the methodologies for maybe you're in a smaller studio and you're getting ready to take the next step and grow, having that kind of like opportunity to learn. But also, I correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I feel like some of the best producers come from those frustrated artists who may not be, to use your term, the rock star creative director, but an artist who understands the pipeline, understands every little bit of like how to make something, but also wants to be able to see a project and have more ownership from a higher level than they would. I feel like that's where that raw material a lot of times is a great place to pull from if you had a system. And this feels like the system to identify and safely test, not in the line of fire, but safely test to see, oh, are your interests really here? Do you have a capability? Can you be mentored to start becoming a producer? Does it fit all three of those profiles?
You know, Ryan, that's a really good point, that when you come from the creative background and your thoughts are being a producer, or you become a producer, what's awesome about that conversion is there's a technical side of production that the creative person knows. Like, they've been in deep inside the software. They know the filters and the rendering issues and the composite problems that would come up, so that they can anticipate them sooner and solve those issues or solve them for multiple people. You know, when you're on the box yourself, you can fix it for yourself. If you take on a producer role or technical producer role, you can systematically fix it for a whole company or even sometimes for a whole industry. So I love when that creative person steps into that role, has that thought and does take on that responsibility. But you can say the tension that would exist is sometimes you're people are taking on that role, you know, in spite to show a producer, I can actually do it.
Right.
And they might be missing some of those other attributes of how do you empathize and how do you add clarity and how do you consider kind of the other pieces of the pie than just the creative. So it, no matter what, I feel like you want multiple sources of input in that production team. So there's balance between that center job, because they really are the spoke of a wheel. And so many decisions are being made for the company and for the project, for the creative, for the client. As Joel said, the cash, like all of those pieces are really going to come together on one person's shoulder. And the method and the practice that they have learned and couldn't put in place is great when it's working in symbiotically with all those elements.
You know, there's a secret tip in there, I think, for a studio that's starting to grow, that's getting larger, and there's decisions to be made for whether it's the EP or the head of production or the owner. You know, that producing core, I've always found this, they're very responsible for what the outward facing culture of a studio actually is perceived as. Whereas the creative directors, really a lot of times, maybe the owner or the creative director can really help establish the inward facing culture, the language you use, the vibe, the way you talk about yourselves. But the producers really manage a lot of what a client may think of you. And I feel like there's a lot of times where that clash of the inward facing culture and the outward facing presentation of it, those break down in terms of like the overall corporate culture, and having an artist in as a junior producer working their way up the line, I feel like helps kind of find that balance where the way you talk about yourself out to the world and the way you talk about yourself inside start to find some kind of equilibrium, I think. And those have been the healthiest producing teams I've worked within when it's a studio that's bigger than an EP and one producer. When you have a team of five or four, you have a squad of producers all trying to keep everything spinning. That mix has, there's been something magical. There's an alchemy when you have that mix, I think, of producers.
Yeah, I think you're describing a certain empathy that just comes from being in the trenches and knowing what it's like to have those 11th hour changes, right, coming through. Mm-hmm. And as an artist, you want to be set up for success. And I think the producers that come from that creative background are the ones that know, oh, I am going to take what this client is saying, this feedback, and I'm going to translate it. Because mm-hmm. if I was a creative, this is how I need to hear it. Or I need to anticipate because I see where this is heading. So therefore, I'm going to set up my artist for success by giving him or her what she needs at this moment so that tomorrow, next week, next month, we're on track and we're winning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've always, I don't know how you guys feel about this, Tim or Joel, but I've always wondered of a studio of a certain size or a certain scale or a certain momentum that there might even be a job title of a like a creative producer who is in that position, that they maybe they're not on a specific job, but they're constantly interfacing with all of the different teams working on the different jobs within the studio that can kind of take the temperature of the creatives in a way that a regular rank and file producer wouldn't be able to because maybe the trust wasn't there, but they could understand and see, look in the artist's eyes, look at the working files, look at the schedule and kind of almost be the like studio-wide go-between between what the artists tell you they think they can get done or what they think is possible versus what really is actually going to happen. Like there's almost like a prognosticator, like a creative producer that also almost can be in at the early pitch or RFP or bidding stage also, that you're not taking the time of the creative producer who's, you know, or creative director who's sitting there and ideating and trying to figure out the pitch. You're not going to pull that person out of that process to say, do you need seven artists or do you need three? Do you think you can get it done in 2 weeks or do you think you can get it in five? I feel like there's almost a hybrid role for the right size studio that could be really, really beneficial that doesn't really have a name yet. I always put in my head a creative producer, but I feel like there's another role that's starting, especially as we start taking on this wider range of types of jobs that are right over the horizon coming up to motion design studios.
Yeah, that's a great question. There, you know, the title creative producer has existed in different segments of our industry. And I think of like when I did movie trailers, a producer there really was kind of the creative director way mm-hmm. more than they were the business manager, like in other segments of the industry. So there is a role there, but you're right. There is an opportunity for someone who's creatively minded and technically minded to do a center role. If you come up through the creative ranks, you usually end up in a technical director role and doing the same thing where a producer asks the TD, can you tell me who I need, how long it's going to take, the software I need? And that technical director can walk through those elements. But coming from the creative side, many producers are creative. Mm-hmm. And so coming up through the producer ranks, that creative producer has that opportunity to say, I know what it takes to get something beautiful out the door. And I understand that some of the creative decisions that can be made, maybe I'd be more viable in a certain producer role than actually be the one pushing the pixels out the door or doing the face-to-face client meetings and getting that presentation done. There's definitely a lot of hybrid opportunities nowadays, especially with remote working, mm-hmm. that we need to fill in the blanks. And so probably a lot more opportunity for people to invent their own job and their own specialty.
I think that's a really great point. I feel like something like this producer masterclass maybe even gives you the tools to be able to define that, right? The next place you go to, there isn't going to be this job title or this role sitting on LinkedIn waiting for you, but the next place you go to, you can craft your own opportunity from the skills and the understanding, the experience you could get from something like the producer masterclass.
Yeah, and the scale of your career having that attribute, I think of when I work on really heavy projects or building out businesses that are a little bit more complicated, more in the technical space or the work I'm doing now with companies in the NFT space, it becomes a lot more complicated because you're dealing with heavy technical issues, some gaming issues, some, you know, art, fine art issues, and then obviously getting stuff out the door as regular kind of motion design production stuff. And that this new element of deliverable is requiring people to think and act differently. And those skill sets can be divided and shifted when you're building up a new economy like that. So some huge opportunities to take advantage of that in the near future.
Well, I want to invite Joel and Tim to join me in raising a glass and taking a drink because you said the magic word. You said NFTs.
It's like the new drinking game, right?
Exactly.
Metaverse or NFT,
yeah. Right? We've done pretty good by not bringing it up too much now. But now that we've talked about producing, we're at the end of the year. It's kind of in the air already. Can I just bother you all to maybe give me a prediction about what 2022 and further, the next 5 years, 10 years of motion design will look like? Because we are living in a world where there are a lot of people in our industry who are going to be asked their opinion of NFTs and DAOs and metaverse and Web3 and decentralized this and machine learning tools. Like, there's so much out there. Is there any one thing that each of you are either super excited about or very concerned about for motion design in the near future?
Well, I'm going to let Tim dive in on the NFT thing first because he's our resident. Is it fair to say expert, Tim? I know they were just invented, you know, not but a year or two ago.
Right. You know, the opportunity that's happening in the crypto space, let's call it, that the NFT contract is allowing for digital ownership in a different way, mm-hmm. is a very exciting platform, especially for digital artists, creative people on a digital platform and ownership of that. You can almost imagine what it's like. It's mixing what music artists and singers were once getting for their songs now can take place in a digital form for JPEGs as well. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a gold rush right now to that, those kind of principles. But that's very short-sighted to what the opportunities are,
right,
in this new decentralized Web3 vision that people are having. And specifically, just how much growth there's about to take place. The analogy I've been using is in this space right now, it's the internet before we even had a web browser. Mm-hmm. I feel like and the NFT contract is the equivalent of inventing HTML.
Right.
So think about how young the internet it was before there was even a web page. Mm-hmm. And we experienced a huge boom in the 1990s, just for websites, just right. Creating websites, which are now so easy and so passive. Google does most of it for you. So the evolutions that have taken place in a 30-year span are about to take place on a new platform. And the exciting part is it's in the digital space, which many of us who are listening to this podcast and have been working on this for years, it's kind of in our own backyard. Mm-hmm. And that's what's exciting. But I want people to lean into that influence that they have and not be afraid and not walk away and not actually commoditize this or put this mm-hmm. down too much of how simple it is. It's truly a large value proposition we have. And our vision often doesn't carry us as far as the opportunities that are there. So
yeah.
I want people to lean into that vision and lean into those opportunities because it'll be a great opportunity for many people in their career and their life in the next 30 years.
I am so as excited as I am for people to finally be recognized for the quality and value of their digital art. I'm also seeing a lot of people taking as their golden ticket out of the industry. What I'm far more interested in on a macro scale, on a wide scale, is how does it reshape the very definition of what motion design is? Because there's an opportunity for it to not just be, motion does not have to be defined as we do what everybody else does, but we just do it for ads. When I see Troika Topline on their website, they normally have, you know, the types of work they do, contact us, about us, whatever it might be. They also now, of the four or five things on top line of their website, they have NFTs and they have fandom. I don't know what that really means right now for one small studio, but in the next year to 3 years, I'm very interested to see how motion design absorbs and leverages everything to do with crypto, NFT, that this entire world, because it's an opportunity, I think, to not just be a order taker.
Yeah, because the brands, here's the good news right now, the brands are in need of your strategy.
Right.
And that's often flipped with their strategy already worked out and given over to motion design companies. So mm-hmm. the fact that they're asking the creative team, the design team to think of a possible strategy, but the education necessary to give good strategic input instead of I can render 10,000 JPEGs for you is a very different proposition. And that's where I think, as Joel joked, it's truly just a couple years old, but the speed at which it's climbing, it feels like a month is a year in this space. To lean in soon so that when given 3 or 5 years from the down the line, you're one of the first people and seeing the trends take place, then you'll have greater expertise to deliver.
Well, Ryan, I like that you use the phrase definition of motion design, because I think like, you remember when motion design wasn't even a term, like we called it motion graphics for a long time, right? You remember that era? And then it became motion design. I think it's, we're going to continue to evolve the definition, because as the years play out, you and I have talked about this a lot. This is like, we're speaking each other's love language here. But motion designers, I think, are tapping into such an interesting amalgamation of disciplines that have so much value to bring to bear in the world, not just for brands, but also just for audiences, for human beings.
Right.
Like, I'm struggling for the words, because when I say motion design, it just sounds like, oh, I'm talking about a cool ad. But I think what we're seeing is that the world is waking up and realizing that we're in this hyper-connected world where everyone is communicating, and the pace at which we're communicating, the richness at which we're communicating, the things that we're experiencing together, these are all things that, and I'm putting motion design in quotes, because what motion design is becoming, I think, is the solution to that need. Yes. And it has myriad applications. So I'm not going to even say, you know, 2D and 3D and VR and AR. No, it's going to go so much farther. But you've talked about it being this intersection of storytelling and communication and typography and screens and all this. I think it's just a very exciting time, because I look at all the owners I've been talking with now that it's end of year, right? In my mastermind and some of our communities, we're starting to do this, reflecting on last year and setting goals for the year ahead and so forth. And you know, one of the common themes that the owners have said about what would you have told yourself back in January 1st of 2021? Okay. Right. Now, knowing what you know now, you know what they pretty much all said? Don't be so afraid.
Yeah.
Yes, there's uncertainty, but you know what? The year played out and everyone, we just talked about it today. There was this one owner that was like, I'm so anxious about 2022. Why? Because there's so much opportunity.
Yes. Yes.
Not like, sure, there's danger and there's risk and it's scary and so forth, but he was groaning about, oh, if only I could capitalize and seize all the opportunities in front of me. I'm excited and I don't know what to do about that. And I think that's overall, that's a statement about the industry, is it's not slowing down anytime soon. So get out there and get out there in the marketplace. I heard this corny phrase, your net worth is your network. Right?
Yes. Like, get that's out almost there. As good as
right?
Yeah. I think what's very interesting about what you just said though, Joel, is that the person you're talking about, there's an anxiety amongst shop owners that they cannot capture and take advantage of the wealth of the work they already know how to do. And they're overwhelmed by that. But I think they're also potentially being really blinded by the amount of opportunity there is by these types of things that Tim is talking about, right? Like, there's an overflow of broadcast and social media and the types of things we're used to doing, but that is masking or hiding the amount of opportunity there is in these Wild West spaces for people who, like, to me, the definition of motion design is not Cinema 4D plus After Effects. The definition of motion design is, unlike every other creative arts industry that got really good at doing one specific thing with one specific type of delivery and one specific type of tool set, motion design at its core is always about being able to do more with less and being able to adopt new technologies and new methodologies and new trends faster than anyone with the fewest amount of people. That's why I think motion design as a philosophy not as a tool set or not as a bunch of companies doing something, as a philosophy, a creative philosophy, is poised to take advantage of all this stuff we just talked about, all these things that in 3 years are going to be commonplace, if not like cliche. We're ready and waiting to be able to problem solve and connect the things together and speak to the clients and speak to the audiences in a way that agencies are not set up, VFX studios are not set up, animation studios are not set up. Like, there's power in the way we approached our projects for the last 20 years that this new field is dying for, that needs.
Gosh, that's such a powerful thought, in that motion design as a philosophy, because there is a perpetual motion that is happening when it comes to creative, isn't it? And there is, no matter what evolution takes place, there will be a creative need, a storytelling need, and execution need. And even if AI were to produce some of those deliverables, the human interaction into that system is a gift that you've been given, and it's your responsibility to grab that gift and implant that in the world to make the world a better place. I think most of us want to live that.
Yeah. No, I'm super excited about it, because I feel like it's a one-time opportunity for an industry to redefine itself, or to capture what it may have, the spirit of it might have been when the industry was like coalescing. That has been why for the previous 5 years I've been very disappointed and frustrated and kind of bored with most of the work that comes out of motion design. And say what you want about NFTs or the kind of like cliched couple of styles that you think of when you think of NFTs, that word is not going anywhere. The blockchain is not going anywhere. Crypto is not going anywhere. That is only going to become more asked for, more wanting to be, you know, helped out with by clients, more understanding is going to be needed by, you know, audiences, that like you're going to have to put a little bit of that initial bias away if you want to take advantage of what you already do right now, what you already offer the world and your clients and your audiences right now.
Yeah, what a huge moment we have. And it's not just, it's a worldwide movement, right? We're seeing more and more worldwide conferences and worldwide movements taking mm-hmm. place in this space. So not only is it expanding just with our own discipline, and I would encourage people to really just think through those three attributes we talked about before of just your business, your life, and your career, and know that which one should have the priority at what time. You know, as much opportunity as it fit before you, it's important to choose the right one for who you are, mm-hmm. what you're about, and the life you want to live. So you're not trying to grab everything and therefore miss it all.
Exactly. Exactly.
But take the one that's in front of you and you know, live it out to your satisfaction is a very important part of having a successful life.
Thank you so much. I just want to, is there a place people can go to find out more about the Producer Masterclass? Somewhere they should look?
Yeah, absolutely. You can always go to our website, revthink.com, and find out about us, join our mailing list. And if you're a creative business owner, join our Rev community space there, where we publish a lot of our articles, have open conversations, do a weekly video podcast, and publish things like the weekly brief or the Producer Masterclass that people can join us. Besides that, obviously, we have every social media platform. If you just look for RevThink, Tim Thompson or Joel Pilger, we exist so people can thrive in business, life, and career. And we say that all the time, and we want people to reach out to us and make that possible.
Well, there you go, Motioneers. There's the producer problem in a nutshell. It's a hard job to define. It's a hard job to find mentorship and training. And the definition is just going to keep expanding as our industry grows and changes with everything that's just across the horizon. But if that job sounds interesting to you, maybe take a look at the Producer's Masterclass with RevThink with Joel and Tim, because it sounds like it's one of the best places to go to learn how to get in the spot in the first place. Well, that's another episode. And as always at School of Motion, we are here to inspire you, to introduce you to new people, and to help elevate the industry the way we really think it should be. Until the next time, peace.